Welcome to Witchlit, a place to talk about the craft of writing and writing the craft. I'm your host, Victoria Rashke, author, publisher, witch, and nosy Scorpio. Witchlit is brought to you by Thousand Bolt Press, a family-owned independent publisher established to produce the books we want to see in the world. Titles including Changing Paths by Yvonne Abreu, Conjuring the Commonplace by Lane Fuller and Corey Thomas Hutchison, and my latest book, Verona Green, can be purchased directly from thousandvoltpress.com or wherever you buy books. Jamie Wagoner is an author, activist, community leader, and creative professional. She is also a longtime student of philosophy, mysticism, spirituality, and the occult. Jamie's background in philosophy, combined with her deep love of myth and story, recently led to the completion of her first full-length book, Hades, Myth, Magic, and Devotion. Jamie is a co-founder and lead instructor of Way of the Weaver, a queer-centric, inclusive program of spiritual inquiry, social justice, and community building. She is also a producer for the upcoming PBS documentary, tentatively titled Sisterhood, Women Can Save the World, from Soulful Media Productions. Her modern feminist approach is inspired by the works of mythologist Drs. Clarissa Pinkola Estes, Sharon Blackie, and Gwilym Morris Baird.
Gwilym Morris Baird.
Thank you. The tarot teachings of Rachel Pollack, the poetry of Mary Oliver and T.S. Eliot, and the paintings of Georgia O'Keeffe. Jamie Wagoner, welcome to Witchlit.
Thank you so much, Victoria. I'm so happy to be here.
I am super happy to have you on. I'm excited to talk about your book. And so our first question for everybody on the show, especially, you know, kind of in this age of visual media, and you've also worked in that media. So why write? Why still write books?
I have wanted to be a writer ever since I was a child. I think the first, you know, when I learned to read, I became a voracious reader, at a very young age. And I just always grew up thinking, this is what I love books. I love writing. I want to write books. Mm-hmm. And even before I'm a full-time freelance creative professional now. So I have a lot more time to work on the projects that really interest me. But even when I was working in the corporate arena, I was pretty much writing full time. I was just writing marketing copy, mm-hmm. which is a different animal.
Right.
So I'm really lucky and really happy to be writing about the things that are near and dear to my heart.
So what did getting this book into the world look like for you?
Oh my goodness. I think it started in 2018. Which is not my first experience with Hades. 2018 was the year I decided to become like a dedicated priestess of Hades. And I had a ritual ceremony and all of those things. And I made certain promises to him as part of that. And I think this book evolved out of the promises that we made to one another during that ritual. I had the idea for the book. It took a few years to kind of unearth it, to use a chthonic metaphor, mm-hmm. because it's very difficult to track down Hades. He's not the main character of any myth. He's always a secondary character or makes cameo appearances here and there. And so it's very, it's interesting to try and find him. You can do it, but you have to piece together a lot of things. You have to look at art, philosophy, poetry, plays. You have to really look to find him. And so, you know, when I was able to piece together enough of an outline and kind of get the idea of where I wanted to go with it, I went to a paranormal convention, actually. And it's held in Illinois every year. It's called Haunted America. It's a great convention. Highly recommend it. And I went there because for a number of reasons. One was to meet Amanda Woomer, who is also a writer, really cool person. She puts out a journal called The Feminine Macabre, and I had contributed article to her journal, and I wanted to meet her there. And I also wanted to take a class from Richard Estep, who's a paranormal investigator and has published a lot with my publisher, which is Llewellyn. He has just published not really in the mind, body, spirit category, but more in the paranormal and true crime categories. But he was giving a workshop on writing and getting published. So I was like, great. Oh, this is awesome. I would love to take this workshop from him. And he was really good. He had great advice about how to make a good elevator pitch, how to make a good outline. And I was able to catch him after the workshop session. And I said, you know, I was planning on attending the Mystic South Conference later that summer, which happens in Atlanta. It's a big metaphysical conference down here. And I was going to have a chance to do the, I think it was referred to as the speed dating pitches mm-hmm. with Lou Ellen. And I mentioned that to Richard and he's like, oh, okay. Okay. I know exactly what you need to do. Here it is. And it gave me great advice. And it ended up working, but not the way I thought it was going to. I never made it to Mystic South that year because my grandmother died and I had to attend her funeral during that week. And so I found the acquisition editor's address. I kind of tracked it down and I emailed her and I said, you know, I really am sorry because I was actually supposed to present at that conference as well. So I had to cancel my presentation, which ironically was about death priestessing to attend the death of a family member. And so, you know, I wrote her and I said, look, I'd really like to send you my pitch and my outline if that's okay with you. And she said, yes. And I was sitting in an airport because I was traveling to another teaching engagement. And so I sent it from the airport and I was talking to my partner on the phone and I said, well, I sent it. I guess we'll see. And before I even got off the phone with him, she emailed me back and she said, this is great. We're interested. And so oh, wow. I was like, okay, I guess this is the moment. And then after that, the book came together really fast, really, really fast. I think because I had been teaching and researching for a number of years before I actually sat down to complete a first draft. It was, you know, I was able to do it pretty quick. I think I did the first draft in about 6 months. So, yeah.
That's awesome. So kind of, obviously this book, you know, is not like an academic text or, but it is clearly a work of love, I think. Like I just... yeah. So do you want to tell people a little bit about, since I assume not everybody will have read it when this comes out, even though the book will be out by then, just kind of give them an overview of how the book is structured? Because I really appreciated the way each chapter kind of unfolds and kind of builds on the previous ones. You want to talk a little bit about that?
Sure, absolutely. So one of the challenges I found when I first started working with Hades in a magical capacity was there was nothing out there to really that explained, like, you know, what are the correspondences? I mean, other than the Hades and Persephone myth, which is in the Homeric hymn to Demeter, there's not really like a lot of like, here's where you go to read the story of who Hades is. So, you know, there wasn't anything telling you how to have a magical working relationship or a devotional relationship with him, really. And I ended up doing a lot of trance journey work, a lot of experimentation, a lot of things like that. And I decided that I wanted to structure the book in a way that it would kind of unfold the whole story of who Hades is. In each chapter, and it includes his voice at the beginning of each chapter, which I have, you know, spent many hours speaking with him in the trance realms. And it includes the epithets, which is basically, an epithet is like a poetic nickname describing a god. So each chapter includes one of his epithets and includes a few plants that are associated with him, either from just kind of their usage in mythology and story, or if they're mentioned specifically with Hades, which sometimes they are, plants that are associated with him, animals that are associated with him, and then a place in the actual landscape of the Mediterranean that's associated with him. Because I think that's very important. I think myth arises from landscape. And, you know, and then there's practical exercises of how to go about it from the very beginning. Like if you know nothing about Hades and you just want to get to know him a little bit and invite his energy into your life, it goes all the way from altar building all the way up to rituals of dedication and everything in between. So I wanted people to be able to enter into a relationship with him and get to know him in a way that was progressive and easy entry. And you know, so that maybe they have a little bit, maybe the path has been cleared a little bit more than when I experienced it. Because I think that they're, I think Hades has a lot to offer. And it's a lot more than just people often, like in sort of like what I would call pop witchcraft, they, you know, Hades is like invoked for like a spell for money, or he's invoked for, you know, to connect with ancestors. And he's so much more than that.
Yeah. I think one of the things that's interesting, like you're right. Like most of what I know about Hades is from other people's myths, you know, other people's stories. And then, you know, like this pop culture resurgence of Hades and Persephone. And they're very popular. Yeah. You talk about that in the conclusion of the book, which I thought was great because I was going to ask, I was like, oh, I want to ask her what she thinks about it. And then you tell us what you think about it. But it's interesting to me, like how present Hades is, like in the current moment, and obviously with your book and all that. And then in, I guess, in the mythology, in the original practice of what we know of it, he was a very hidden god. You didn't speak his name. You didn't look upon his face. He wasn't depicted so that you could see his face. And then, you know, you weren't allowed to share the offerings, or you had to turn your back, or only a priest could do it. So what, so how do you think like that flip to this very almost famous, I guess, you know, to go from this hidden god to kind of this like celebrity god right now?
Yeah. I'm not sure when the exact flip occurred. But no, that's very true. I mean, you're very right. In the ancient world, it was, you know, he was always referred to by euphemism, often referred to as the wealthy one, or the quiet one, or something like that. People didn't, it was an act of magic. They didn't want to, preventative magic. They didn't want to invite death close to them by, you know, by invoking the, you know, the ruler of the land of the dead into their presence. You know, and that, you know, I mean, you can understand. I mean, I think also, you know, we're a little bit further removed from death in the modern world. I think in the ancient world, death was visible all the time. You know, and such a part of life that, you know, people had certain mechanisms for trying to work with that, trying to deal with that. And we're a little further removed these days. Even the food that we eat comes prepackaged in plastic at the grocery store, right? So I don't know. I want to say it's probably for a few different reasons. I think that people are, they're fascinated by a mystery and Hades is mysterious. So I think that there's a little bit of curiosity there. I think that you know, right now in the world, there is a lot of societal and cultural upheaval. There's a lot of climate chaos. There are ongoing conflicts around the world, pandemics, things like that. These very Plutonian themes that are happening right now. And I think that the resurgence of Hades in pop culture and fan fiction is concurrent with all of these like kind of like maybe the shadow side of that, right?
Yeah, like that. And it is funny you say, like, in ancient Greece, death was a neighbor, basically. Like, yeah, it was basically just, you know, in the marketplace, you saw animals being slaughtered, you saw dead bodies, you know, you tended to your own family's dead, all of those things.
Yes.
And now we are so removed from it. And yet we embrace like the shadow and the darkness of these, like Hecate and Hades and these who were considered chthonic deities are now like superstars in you know, kind of witchcraft and occult circles. And it's interesting to me.
Yeah, I think that
disconnect, you know, yes.
Yeah. And I think that, you know, sometimes I liken it to like the interest in these in chthonic deities to it's almost like watching scary movies. Like you want to scare yourself in a healthy way. So, you know, it's a way that we can engage with some of these themes that are scary and intimidating. But engaging in myth and story allows us to sort of do that in a way that is just a tad bit safer for us, you know, emotionally, mentally. And I think that might be part of the attraction as well.
Yeah. One of the things I thought was interesting in the book, I mean, obviously you did a lot of research. I have a long list of books I want to go now read, which is always the rabbit hole of every new book. Right?
I'm really proud of my bibliography.
Yeah, no, it was fantastic. I love a thick bibliography.
I do too, because I'm a nerd.
I'm really proud of it. But I also love that you interviewed folks.
I did.
Do you want to talk about like that, how you went about that for the book and like who you decided to talk to? And because I just think that was a really interesting way to talk about the current moment.
Yeah. Yeah. So I definitely wanted to interview. So I'll tell you right now, you know, the number one chapter that I was concerned about, because, you know, Hades is, yes, he is popular in like pop culture, or like a fan fiction kind of mode. But as, you know, an actual god figure or an actual unseen being, some folks are very scared of him still.
Yeah.
And you know, rightly so. They have, you know, that's completely valid. It's valid to be scared of death. It's valid to be scared of a being that represents that. The chapter that I was most concerned about, just trying to treat it well and with integrity and respect, was actually chapter 3, which is the chapter about Hades and Persephone. The epithet for that chapter is Kleimenos, and it means notorious, which is one of the epithets that Hades has. In fact, in ancient statuary, when Hades and Persephone appear side by side on thrones, they're usually pictured that way because it has to do with fertility and with rich soil that will yield fertile crops. It doesn't say Hades, like it's not inscribed with Hades, it's inscribed Kleimenos near him. So, you know, I really wanted to treat the subject matter of that myth very well, because it does deal with, you know, potential assault and certainly with kidnapping. And, you know, so I wanted to interview a Persephone devotee and have them speak about, you know, their experiences in working with Persephone and how, what they thought of the myth. So that's kind of what started the idea. And then I just, through kind of interacting on social media and like some people I've been following on the internet, just doing some really fascinating work. So I interviewed a transmasculine priestess, Murphy Robinson. I interviewed a Black death doula working in the South, Michaela Ricks. And I interviewed a Hades devotee who has sort of a devoted Instagram to Hades named Brittany. And Brittany actually lives in South America. So, you know, it's quite a cohort of folks for the different topics. But I wanted to show some different opinions of things other than just my own. Mm-hmm. And I also wanted to, you know, it's very important to me in my magical work and my teaching and writing to be inclusive. And there's a chapter, chapter 5, and it talks about Hades and masculinity, you know, and I wanted to include the voice of a transmasculine priestess to kind of give it, you know, give a different perspective. And I think it's really important to have multiple voices and multiple perspectives when you're looking at these stories.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I learned a new word from your book, the Zetron, or the...
Oh, Zetron. Yeah. Yeah.
Which I thought was great. I was like, okay, yeah. Because, you know, matron deity or patron deity. And mm-hmm. if they are non-binary or you are non-binary and you're not comfortable with those terms.
Zetron. Yeah. It's like a Z on the front of the. Yeah. That came from Sage Elwin, one of my beloved students. And, you know, it's interesting because I do. You know, the classes I teach, we market them as being queer centric and inclusive, you know, because mm-hmm. we want people to know that right up front. And with, you know, with deity work, they are assigned genders in mythology for the most part, which doesn't make sense. I feel like some of these beings are kind of above and beyond gender. I mean, that's kind of a human construct. I don't think that really matters to them. Mm-hmm. And I always tell my students, like, you know what, go in your trance journey and speak with them and ask them about it if that's something that concerns you, and then just see what they have to say. And it turns out, you know, some of them don't really care Yeah. And so students have come up with these really creative things like Zatron to sort of honor that. And yeah. also I think that, it helps, folks that are like, on different parts of the gender spectrum or non-binary, it kind of helps them feel like they're being mirrored by the unseen ones. You know, they're seeing themselves in that which is larger, which is really amazing.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I always think, like human gender and sexuality is so fluid. Why would, deity be rigid?
Exactly. Exactly.
It totally makes sense to me. But I do appreciate that in your book. And I think it's something, I think gratefully that we are seeing more of, that people are kind of aware of that and cognizant. And I feel like a lot of the books that I've read for the podcast, I feel like that's really more common in newer books, even from people who have been writing a long time and might not have started their craft that way. Like, I feel like there's a shift across the board, which is nice to see.
Yeah, I think it's good. Yeah, I see a shift as well. I would concur.
So for you, with your, being a priestess of Hades, this book and getting this book out into the world, how has that deepened or changed kind of your practice around it? Or what? Because I feel like this is not just a business transaction of I did some work and I'm getting paid for it. I feel like there's more to it than that.
No, it's not just a business transaction. I definitely feel like I know him I feel like I know him in a much more intimate way than I did when I first started writing the book. Hades is not the first deity that I've worked with. Hades is interesting because I used to work mostly with the Welsh pantheon, with goddesses from the Mabinogion. And it's interesting to work with Hades because he is so one-on-one, kind of hands-on in my life. And it's kind of like the more I study and teach about him, the more he reveals himself, but also the more, I can just kind of see, this is my personal belief system. Not everybody believes this, but I can kind of see behind the scenes how events are unfolding to provide opportunities and to not only get the book out there, but also support me personally in many ways, not just as a priestess. So, it's an incredible relationship. It's a very different deity relationship than I've had before. It feels much more one-on-one than some of the other gods and goddesses that I've encountered.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I think that's, to me, the work of a book, I always think, readers get this finished product that's, passed through a few hands.
Right.
And has been edited and all of that. But I feel like each book kind of has its own egregore by the time it gets out into the world.
And then
readers add to that, right? Readers each mm-hmm. create their own artifact with the book or the copy of it that they have. Mm. So as the author of the book, what do you want the readers to take away from it? What do you hope readers take away from this book?
Hope that, there's multiple things. I think the first and foremost thing I want them to take away is a better understanding of the whole picture of who Hades is. To broaden their understanding in that way, even if they choose not to work with them at all, but maybe they'll just be like, okay, this was really interesting. And now my eyes have been opened to something I formerly didn't know about. That would be my first desire. I think my other desire is, I've put some deeply personal stories in the book. I talk about my insomnia, my night terrors, the fact that I had to give myself permission to love Hades. I talk about all kinds of very deeply personal things. And I included that because I want people to feel less alone in their weirdness. And I put those things in because I don't you know, even if I never meet the reader who identifies with those things, I want them to be at home and be like, okay, like there's, I'm not alone in this. There's at least one other weirdo out there that's experienced these things. And so I think that's the second thing that I would really like readers to take away.
Yeah. Well, I will say I felt less alone in my weirdness.
Yay!
Because I do think, you know, like how we encounter these beings, and you talk about that, like maybe you just are drawn to their energy, or maybe they call to you, you know, it just kind of depends. And then I think it was the idea, the thing I really liked about the book is like, it's kind of a roadmap for anyone who kind of has this either devotion or interest or attraction to kind of lesser known or obscure deities, mm-hmm. because we do kind of have to dig, because there's not a lot about the, you know, some, like one of the deities that I have a real interest to, I would not call it a devotional practice with him, is Acheloas, the river god. And part of that is from travel and being in places where he was, you know, worshipped, or, you know, devotees practiced for him. And like, yeah, there's just not a lot out there, mm-hmm. you know? And so I think having your book is a way to go, okay, here's a way to build a practice with, you know, this being that we might not have that much information about, although I think you might have more Hades than Acheloas, but
you know. I was joking with a friend of mine. I'm like, you know, at the, you know, since the book is out now, and I, you know, I've done a couple podcast interviews at this point and other things, and, you know, considering like my fall teaching schedule, and, you know, do I want to teach about mm-hmm. Hades or do a book study or something? I'm like, you know, I might actually end up being one of the people like in the entire history of like humanity who said the name Hades like this much, which cracks me up, first of all. And then, you know, actually, you know, listening to you say that, you know, maybe that's another, like a third way that people could also have a big takeaway from this book is like, not, you know, if you don't want to apply this to Hades, apply it to your obscure deity that you're mm-hmm. trying to work with, you know, because I think the methodology is applicable.
Yeah, no, I think so too, especially if they happen to come from Greek or probably even Roman pantheon. There's a lot of overlap there with how things were done. And maybe when, I mean, one of the things I think is interesting with Hades, especially, is as far as we know, there was not like a devotional day to Hades, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, there's not like a Hades festival.
No, I mean, no. As far as we know, I have not uncovered that yet. I will be very excited if I uncover that in my research. You know, the closest thing would be celebrations of the mysteries of Persephone and Demeter, in which sometimes Hades figures took part. You know, that would be like the closest thing.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that makes sense. And I think, you know, thinking about the Persephone myth, and it's interesting to me how that gets played out in kind of modern tellings mm-hmm. about, you know, is it a kidnap and a rape, or is it she wanted to go willingly and this was the way to make it happen because mom didn't want it? You know, I mean, it's this weird, like, and I know that there are multiple tellings in the mythology itself, so there's room for those interpretations. But it's interesting to me, like, that it's occasionally a source of contention for people. Like, mm-hmm. and I think because it does evoke big feelings and big emotions, and, you know, can absolutely trigger trauma and all of those things.
Yeah. So. Yeah. I am a feminist from the way back. And I oftentimes am very tempted to like go along with modern, more feminist reinterpretations where Persephone has agency in the situation and is, you know, sort of, you know, maybe even an architect of this, like, you know, a faux kidnapping to get away from mom. But we don't, you know, at the end of the day, we don't know what's true about mm-hmm. that myth. We don't know. We do know at the time there was a lot of assault. In the Greek world, there was it was very dangerous to be a woman in the, or, you know, someone who was considered feminine in that world. So we don't know, is the myth a reflection of the mm-hmm. overculture of the time? Most likely, you know, it's very likely. You know, and so that's why I talk about in that chapter, I think it's, well, I mean, a couple points. I think that it's important to, especially if you're going to be a devotee of Hades, it's important to listen to all the perspectives out there and not invalidate anyone, especially mm-hmm. if someone has been, you know, has been traumatized themselves, and they may have very deep emotional feelings about this. And that is valid and should be respected. You know, and I think, you know, the other thing that I think is interesting is in doing my trance work to sort of retrieve this part of Hades mythos, Persephone weighed in, she had some opinions. And part of what was gifted to me from Hades was this idea that no one will ever be able to solve what happened, like whether she went willingly, whether she wanted to stay, whether, you know, whether she goes back unwillingly every year. It's always going to be a mystery that can't be solved. There are always going to be conversations about it. And maybe that's on purpose so that we keep having these conversations, so that we keep bringing the matter of consent up, so that we keep trying to basically become better, kinder humans, you know, and that might be part of the magic of a very confusing and somewhat controversial myth.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I like that. I like that. The mystery is the point kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So a little bit of a 180, but I want to make sure I ask you about this because I was fascinated. So in, like you said, in each chapter, there's a part that's about the landscape of like where the myth, where different things in the mythos take place. And so I just kind of wanted to talk about, see if you would talk about your travels in Greece and Sicily and talk about like being in these places and just what that was like, because I've had the opportunity to do a little bit of that with other things, and it can be really overwhelming or really underwhelming occasionally. So do you want to talk about your own experience with that?
I think probably what I want to talk about is being at the cave of the Cumaean Sibyl, which is in Cuma in Italy. It's near Naples. And it's a really tiny town. You have to take like, I was actually in Rome and took like the trip there from Rome. So I had to take a train and then a commuter train and then two buses and then walk to Cuma. And my partner figured out how to get there, which was wonderful. We call him the pigeon because he always knows like where to go. Mm-hmm. He can always find his way. And being in that place of like an ancient oracle and kind of navigating, this place that's been carved out of the rock there, and then looking out over the Bay of Naples and, some of the other places in that area. It's, there was just a very deep earth sense of being there and of sort of the pull and the presence of the underworld, was very distinct, was really, really distinct. It's so interesting. I think that, you know, I think you can feel the energy of Hades or the underworld anywhere you are, even if you're in your backyard per se. But there's something about the layers of belief that have existed in that place for millennia that I think makes it even easier to tap in. It's almost like it's louder. It's like the volume's turned up, you know?
No, that makes sense. It's so interesting to me, especially when you like that, it sounds like that place is kind of removed, but like sometimes these are like in the middle of the city.
Yeah.
Like I think about like the Mithraeum under a bank in London.
Right, like, right.
Which I haven't gotten to go to, but in my next trip to London, it is on the list.
There's actually like a motor speedway built over one of these sites. And so, you know, there's like, you know, it's so interesting because you can almost, if you're a person who's like intuitive and kind of open to these things, like you have this autodrome, it's like cars racing and racing and racing. And then under that is like this magical field where part of this myth could have happened. You know, mm-hmm. it's a very interesting feeling, like yeah. the modern overlays. Yeah.
Yeah. My husband and I went to Stonehenge on a visit about 10, 11 years ago to England. And, you know, we went on a bus, you know, kind of the same pilgrimage thing. We took a bus mm-hmm. from London. And we walk up to the plane, you know, to the kind of where Stonehenge is. And for folks who haven't been, you can't actually walk up to the stones. There's like a path you walk around the outside of the stones, and it's clockwise. And my husband, who does not particularly claim to be an occultist of any kind, was like, all he could think about was like all these people walking clockwise around Stonehenge and basically charging it, which I was
basically.
I hadn't really thought about that.
I'm really lucky. I've been to Stonehenge twice. And the second time was in 2011. And I went with a pilgrimage. It was a Sisterhood of Avalon, which is a group I used to belong to. And it was part of our pilgrimage. And we actually got to go in the middle of Stonehenge. We got in touch with English Heritage, which is like the society that preserves mm-hmm. the site. And we're able to get, we had to go really early. It was like 6 a.m. Before anybody came. And we got to like go in the middle, and it was like no touching of anything. All you can do is basically go in and stand. And it was phenomenal. It was amazing. But actually, I love what your husband said. That's hilarious. Because now that I think about it, because there's just so many people just constantly circling.
Yeah. And I was like, maybe there's something to that. Because on that same trip, we went to Bath. And, you know, to the mm-hmm. Minerva Sulis Shrine and all that in Bath. And I was
I wonder if we took the same little tour, because I did that too the first time I was there.
Yeah, we stayed in an Airbnb with folks, like in an apartment with people who were living there. We just stayed in their guest room. And we were like, we're going to drive. And they're like, don't drive. Go get one of the tour buses. Trust me. You will hate yourself if you drive. And I was like, okay. So we did it and it was great. But yeah.
You know, in talking about place, you know, on that pilgrimage, I mean, it was amazing. We went to a few different places in the UK. We went to Somerset, particularly to Glastonbury, and to the coast in Cornwall, and into Wales a little bit, to sort of kind of sink into the landscape of the myths that we worked with. And it was a wonderful trip. I mean, I absolutely. It was amazing seeing all the places. It was amazing, all the ritual and the you know, the magic that we did there and things that we learned. I expected a little bit more sort of almost like a heartfelt homecoming kind of feeling mm-hmm. when I was there. And I was surprised that that didn't happen for me. It seemed to happen for a few other people, but not that it was bad or that it ruined the trip. I mean, it was fine, but it was just, it was unexpected. And I had a completely different experience traveling in the Mediterranean. I just felt so completely like at home, like mm-hmm. like very deep, like in my bones. Like, you know, there's something here that is, you know, that really calls to me, that I really feel the spirit of the place. So, yeah, it was just, you know, that was kind of like another one of the differences between working with the gods and goddesses of the Mabinogian versus when I started working with Hades.
Mm-hmm. I mean, could you tell like when you got there, like off the plane, or was it like going specifically to the sites when you were in the Mediterranean?
I think it was getting, I mean, it's interesting because there are so many ancient ruins just kind of there, like interspersed with modern cities and like, you know, modern activities going on. So, yeah, I think it's, you know, I think definitely in Italy, it was just there. Like, I just immediately felt mm-hmm. that, like, as you know, it wasn't when I got off the plane. I think it was probably when because we stayed in the old historic, like, center of the city in the neighborhood of Monte. And I think it was my first glimpse of, like, the Colosseum, just kind of, like, out of the corner of my eye. And then after that, like, it just really hit me kind of all in a wave. And it certainly, I think, increased when you can go to like the archaeological parks and places that are a little bit, you know, a little bit fewer and far between, because you have a chance to sort of the activity of the humanity sort of decreases, and you can kind of really sense, you know, you can sense the energetics of the land. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you can kind of, I always like to imagine like why a particular myth or a particular description in a piece of ancient text, why it arose like from this place. And, you know, I think it gives me, it gives a lot more insight.
Mm-hmm. So did you do any of the travel while you're writing the book, or did all of that happen before you were writing?
Oh, it was before. Yeah, it was before. I wrote the book in, let's see, it was 20, I was, my goodness, what I'm trying to remember.
I know, like what is time?
The pandemic years are a blur.
Mm, yes.
Sorry, I began, I pitched the book in 2022, got the contract, really began writing then, and finished the complete draft in 2023. Mm-hmm. So, and work through obviously the subsequent edits and things like that. So yeah. Sort of like many people, I haven't done an extensive amount of traveling since, the COVID-19 pandemic in 2019.
Yeah. Same. I had tickets in hand that didn't happen because of all, so it's still kind of a bummer. I always joke though that, you know, one of the great things about being a writer is that sometimes that travel is tax deductible. So, although I have gotten taken advantage of it the last couple of years. So. Awesome. So now that this book is out, because like by the time this comes out, the book will have been out for a couple months. What do you see like for writing for you? Like what's next? Do you have like a mountain you want to climb or?
Well, actually, there are a couple projects that I'm already starting to outline and like plan as far as dates go. I don't know if you yourself are probably familiar with this, and some of your listeners might be, but there's something called National Novel Writing Month each November. And they always joke that there are two kinds of people. There's like the planners and the pantsers, and the planners plan things out. The pantsers fly by the seat of their pants. I'm definitely in the planner camp. So, I've started planning two books. One is actually a sequel to Hades, Myth, Magic, and Modern Devotion, because the ancient Greek underworld is such a rich place. There are so many denizens down there beyond just Hades and Persephone. And so I cover them a little bit in Hades, but it, you know, I want to go into that a little bit with a little bit more depth. And I'm a plant nerd. I love plants. I do a lot of magic with plants. I grow plants. I put 20 plants in Hades out of my list of like 50 that I wanted to get in there. So, you know, I'd like to put more plant magic in there. I'd like to, you know, do, you know, just kind of develop that a little bit more. So that's on the table, a sequel to Hades. I don't have a working title yet. and the other project I'm working on that, is different. It's kind of separate from my magical practice, my spiritual practice. I'm a producer for a film for PBS. It's tentatively titled Sisterhood, How Women Can Save the World. And with that film, I will be traveling around the world. I'll be traveling to six different continents during the filming. And my intention is to interview women as I'm traveling. Mm-hmm. And to do sort of a travel memoir of the filming. So, you know, both those projects are on the table.
Yeah. So for the PBS project, is that like a go? I mean, when does that start or what's the situation there?
It has a commitment to air from PBS for March of 2027. That's Women's History Month. Mm-hmm. So it is, of course, dependent on funding. And so we are in the process. PBS doesn't fund it. They just committed to air the movie once it's complete. So we're in the process right now of writing for several grants to fund the film. We've already gone through the development and pre-production phases. We're actually in production right now. gathering a lot of archival materials, archival footage and photos and things like that that we need. But our major filming on location, hopefully dependent on funding, will occur next year in 2025.
Oh, okay. So yeah, so you're in the soup already, but not in the travel part. Awesome.
Yeah, exactly.
That sounds really exciting.
None of it's not fun, but we haven't gotten to the really fun part.
I worked in television the early part of my adult career after grad school. Mm-hmm. And, you know, one of the things when I would tell people what I was doing, they'd be like, oh, that's so exciting. And I was like, if only you knew.
It's not as glamorous as it sounds.
There are exciting things about it. I mean, you get to meet interesting people and go places, but it's also a whole lot of standing around. There's a whole lot of standing around in television.
I bet. Yeah. I've never worked in television specifically. I've worked on commercials before, like commercials and like informational videos and things like that. And yeah, there is a lot of hurry up and wait.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's like, oh, this light's in the wrong place. And then it takes four guys an hour and a half to move it and make sure all the electric's okay and it's not going to fall on anybody. And all good reasons that things happen the way they do. But no one tells you that. And definitely as a viewer, you would never know that somebody spent an hour and a half standing around waiting for someone to move a light. So,
yeah. Well, for the movie that we're working on, we're kind of a scrappy little crew. There's myself. There's the director, Dr. Isidore Leidenfrost. And then we have a sound person that goes on site with us. And we have an interpreter. It depends on where we are. We'll have an interpreter. So, like I said, we're a little, you know, tiny but powerful crew. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I was thinking when you're saying the follow-up to Hades to kind of get back to that part of writing. So we talked about this already, but like at the beginning of each chapter, Hades tells his own story. Like you've written a first person account of Hades telling his own story. Yeah. And I was just thinking, I want this novel. Like I want the whole thing. Like I want the Achilles, you know, of Hades. Yeah, because I was just like, this is so beautiful. I just want the whole story.
Thank you so much. Well, you know, I have to give the credit back to him. Those really are his words. I mean, I would go into Trance Journey, you know, talk about the chapter, ask questions about the particular myth that I was researching and ask him to retell it to me for this particular audience right now. Because I do believe that just like us, stories and the gods themselves are capable of evolution. And then I would come out of my trance journey and furiously scribble down what I heard him say. And sometimes I had to go back and like ask again so that I could get, you know, really get the nuance of it. But, you know, I fully intend to do that work for any sequels that I do to Hades because I really do love that kind of trance journey and sort of oracular or channeling sort of work. It's really near and dear to my heart. It's interesting. I don't disapprove of fiction writers who have taken the story of Hades and Persephone. I mean, it's very, very popular with romantic fiction writers and redo it. I don't oppose any of that, but I have found that since I've become a Hades devotee, I can no longer enjoy them. because they're just so, I mean, it ends up being like someone talking about like someone that you know intimately, but just not getting it all wrong.
Right.
Yeah. Which is, you know, it's kind of like, I can't handle sort of the cognitive dissonance that occurs. Mm-hmm. So I don't, you know, I don't really consume a lot of that anymore.
Yeah. And that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I would love to, I do like to write fiction. I have a couple fiction novels that I've started, but I've never really pursued. Mm-hmm. They're, you know, they're just kind of, I call them practice projects. They're just kind of fun to like get into and get words flowing. And they are actually, you know, retellings of mythology in the first person voice. One of them that I started was, again, when I was working with the goddesses of the Mabinogion. It's a retelling of Bronwyn, daughter of Lear, which is the second branch of the Mabinogion. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I haven't really considered doing something like that with Hades, but I suppose I could.
Well, if you don't want to, hopefully we will put a bug in Hades' ear to have some contact with Madeline Miller, because I love her Achilles book. And let's see what she could do with Hades.
Exactly. Yeah. So it's really interesting. And I don't really know. He hasn't shared with me yet what's on his mind, because he spent so many millennia being the unseen one and kind of operating behind the scenes.
Yeah.
And as we started talking about at the beginning of this interview, he's not so unseen anymore. Like he's out there. So, and now there of course is the book that's coming out from Llewellyn all about him. And maybe I hope garnering some more fans and devotees for him.
Yeah. It's funny you say about not enjoying it. Like I have read the whole Lore Olympus run. I think she's on the last leg of it right now. It's about to wrap up. And there's just been times where like I've really enjoyed the story of it, but I'm also like, wait. I mean, obviously some license with the mythology and things like that. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But I find it interesting how much like she's been able to pull in some pretty obscure like figures and stuff into that story.
Yeah.
It's been really interesting to watch. Read,
the creator is Rachel Smith. Mm-hmm. And I believe that she is in New Zealand, I think is where she's located. Yeah. But yeah, I've read the whole thing on Webtoon as well, and was very impressed. I was like, okay, the creator is like actually like doing the research, like not just taking kind of the surface version of this story.
Yeah, it's been interesting. It's the only thing I read on Webtoons. So when it wraps up, I don't know what I'll do with myself. But I've really enjoyed it. And I don't know, it's just interesting to see like, trendiness sounds like the wrong word because it sounds a little too superficial, I guess, but maybe resurgence is the right word. Of Hades and his underworld denizens. Like it's kind of nice to see us kind of go back to that. So
I particularly enjoy Hecate in Lore Olympus. I really like how Rachel kind of like presents Hecate, and I think that's one of my favorites.
She's very business. She's very business, which I like. She's not.
It's just these great like glowing yellow eyes.
kind of like her internal torches or something.
Exactly.
No, I do really like that. So I will mention this at the top for people to know, but our conversation got interrupted, so I'm not exactly sure where we are on time. But in the interest of keeping us sort of under an hour.
Okay.
People know I fail a lot. But I wanted to give you an opportunity to just kind of tell people like where to find your stuff. Like, you know, if you have any events coming up, like I said, this will air at the beginning of June. So like, you know, just let people know where to find you and what's going on.
Yeah, absolutely. So everything that I do, all the events, all the classes I teach, I also have a podcast with my teaching collaborator, Murphy. It's called The Way of the Weaver. All of that's on my website, which is jamiewagoner.com. So you can go check that out. There's links to buy the books and other books that I've contributed to. And I do have a couple events coming up that are both really fun. And, you know, if you're interested in joining me there, I would love to meet you. If you're listening, one of them is our Way of the Weaver camp. We do a summer camp every year, and it's in Vermont. It's in the mountains, and it really is kind of a big, witchy, magical camp out for adults.
Nice.
And everything with the Way of the Weaver program is queer-centric and very inclusive, and we're not part of any particular magical tradition. We, you know, invite everyone to come, whatever your background, even skeptics. We have some wonderful skeptics that come. And we just meet and we have, you know, magic ritual. We kind of do some different classes kind of depending on the theme for the year. But that will be happening in June. So Weaver Camp happens June 27th through the 30th. And enrollment is not open right now. It is limited because the grounds where we camp will only hold so many people.
Oh, okay.
So if you join my newsletter list, then you'll definitely know when it's open because I'll publish that the enrollment is open.
Okay.
So that's really fun. If you want to, relive your younger summer camp years with a bunch of very, very, very kind, wonderful humans. And then the next thing that is happening after that is the Mystic South Conference, which happens in Atlanta, Georgia, each summer. And it's basically a big witchy metaphysical conference that takes place indoors in a hotel. You can do ritual with air conditioning. It's amazing, especially in the South. And that's happening the 26th to the 28th of July. And you can go to the Mystic South website and get all the details on that. I will be putting in some teaching proposals for Mystic South. Of course, that's up to them whether they accept them or not, but I will definitely be there no matter what. And I can, you know, I'll have copies of Hades, and of course, we'll be happy to sign them and chat with folks that want to do that. So,
Mystic South, I'm like, having, you know, lived in the South most of my life, I'm like, oh yeah, that better be indoors in July.
Yeah, it is bug free. Yeah, air conditioning. It's great. And I've gone to a lot of conferences and a lot of pagan events, and it's very well put together. It's mm-hmm. very well organized. Yeah.
I mean, I'm always impressed with their like call for presentations and papers. Like I feel like, mm-hmm. you know, they really run it pretty well. Like it seems like it's run pretty well.
I was impressed with a lot of things about them. I was impressed with the diversity in their keynotes for the conference. I was impressed that when I got there on site and registered, there were pronoun stickers to put on your badge and things like that. Nice. So, I found it to be a very welcoming community.
Oh, good. Yeah. I had thought I might go this year, but we've just had so much going on. I'm like, okay, maybe next year. See what happens. Awesome. Well, cool. So our last question for everybody is our little game of chance. And, I always joke, it's my Scorpio nature to want to talk about things we're not supposed to talk about. And having
I have
grown
a Scorpio rising.
So you know this.
Yeah,
you know
I do.
This.
Yeah.
And you also live in the South, so you know the mm-hmm. things you're not supposed to talk about in polite company mm-hmm. rule. Mm-hmm. which always bothered me because those are always the things I want to talk about. So I will roll this lovely little die. And depending on what I roll, you'll get a question about death, sex, religion, politics, or money.
Ooh, okay.
And if I roll a six, you get to pick which one you want. And you can say skip if you get one you don't want. Two, sex.
Okay.
So we've talked about this a little bit. But so in a lot of romance right now, there's like this very strong thread of retellings of Hades and Persephone as romance novels. So I guess, what do you think Hades thinks of being a sex god in modern romance?
That's a great question. my experience of Hades is that he doesn't strut because he doesn't have to. He's very... he kind of takes fame with a grain of salt. He's super grounded, as you would expect the ruler of the underworld to be. And I do mention this in my book just a little bit. Hades, when you are interacting with him in a ritual situation, or, you know, even in your own trance journeys, but certainly in community rituals, he is attractive. He is magnetic. You know, when I do, I call it trance possession. Some people call it channeling. There's lots of terms for the magical technology. People queue up to speak to Hades, and you know, he takes it in stride. I think secretly he finds it amusing.
Yeah,
but he certainly does. He doesn't take advantage of it. He just kind of takes it in stride. So, I have a feeling that. You know, I haven't seen this in my trans journeys, but I'm seeing in my mind's eye, I'm just picturing when Persephone's in the underworld bringing one of the, you know, like young adult romance paperbacks down there to about their story, especially the sex scenes. And they're probably, he's probably blushing and she is probably laughing her head off.
Yes. Yeah, I could see that too. Yeah. I have a book club. Because we all do a lot of serious stuff. So we read pretty much smut. Like that's kind of.
Yeah, I love smut.
Yeah. But we read Neon Gods, Roberts, Neon Gods, which is centered on Persephone. And it's like very tangential retelling, I should say. Like mm-hmm. she's kind of established her own mythology around it. And they live in a city, you know, it's this whole thing.
Yeah.
And, everybody in the group was like, okay, this was really touted as really smutty, and we're all like, is it really smutty? I thought it was an interesting take. Funny. It was an interesting take on their relationship. I don't know that I liked it as much as like I wanted to, but I thought it was an interesting retelling.
Yeah. So. Well, like I said, I can't personally read the books anymore.
Yeah, exactly.
Because I'm just, you know, I'm like, I have a different relationship with him, and I just can't, like, it's just weird. But I think the only thing that, you know, I think the most annoying thing that I, you know, encounter, and it's kind of like when you go into a metaphysical store. My husband and I are always joking about, we always look around the statues for the shredded Hades, which is just like the Hades that's like bare chested, like wearing like some sort of little cross between a Roman legionnaire skirt and a kilt. Mm-hmm. And, you know, has like chains and like, you know, like, you know, he's like chaining, you know, Kerberos, and he's like, you know, it's just the shredded Hades, which is just like so outrageous. And I think, you know, the things that bother me in modern fiction portrayals is when there's a tendency by some romance writers to kind of put him in this sort of almost like, it's like a borderline controlling sort of like dominating male figure, which I think is a little cringy for me. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that was probably my, I don't want to say like really negative things about, but that was kind of my takeaway from Neon Gods. It was like, I just don't imagine Hades kind of like a Christian Grey kind of character.
Yeah, no, it's not my experience of.
No. No, it's like, no, it didn't really work for me. I think, and maybe that's why I like Rachel Smith's take in Lore Olympus, because he is really caring. Like, he's so considerate of Persephone and her feelings and her trauma and dealing with his own trauma. And like, I think that's why I like that telling a little better. But yeah, it's funny to me. It's just funny to me. Like, of all of the Greek gods, to, you know, for Hades to be
why he's the one. I think, you know, also it's, I mean, for those of us that like that, I mean, I don't know. Sometimes you just like a bad boy, right? And even though I wouldn't consider him, you know, from the spiritual side, right? Like the magical spiritual side, I would not consider him a bad boy at all. But, you know, I think that romance writers tend to kind of pick up that theme and go with it.
Yeah, I would say Hades is my actual favorite kind of bad boy, is the one who looks like a bad boy, but isn't actually.
Yeah, exactly. He really just, you know, likes his dog a lot and his wife.
Yeah, like he's very loving and kind and kind of a teddy bear, but has this bad boy persona. Like, that's my favorite kind of bad
boy. Maybe he gets that because he's mysterious. Like, death is mysterious. He's mysterious. You know, the underworld is sort of shrouded in the metaphorical mist, as it were. So, yeah.
Yeah, cool. Awesome. Well, Jamie, thank you so much for this. This has been a lovely conversation.
You're welcome.
Thank you for making an extra time to come back and record the end, since Comcast decided we needed to do this twice. And yeah, I'm so looking forward to your projects coming up and the next book and the movie and all of that. So this is exciting.
Yeah, I love it. Thank you so much. This was really fun. And I'm really happy to have met you. And I look forward to seeing more of your work as well. Thank you.
Awesome. Witchlit is a production of Thousand Volt Press and is edited by Julian Rashke. Our intro music is Cosmic Glow by Andrew Kay, and our outro music is Voices by Alexander Shenekar. Transcripts and all our previous episodes are available at witchlitpod.com, and you can follow us on Instagram and Threads at witchlitpod. Please help other witches find us by leaving a rating or review wherever you listen to podcasts. Thank you for listening to and reading Witchlit.